Megan had a term paper she turned in toward the end of school this year. And at the end of it is a bibliography. You write down the sources that you refer to, then you type them up at the end and you list them. It's required to do it that way. The bibliography is, again, a reference to those people who you use their words in your paper. See, when an author writes something, it's generally protected. It's called copyright. And if you ignore the copyright, it's called plagiarism. And there's people who have lost their jobs, especially in academia or in other places, maybe in medical professions in various ways, because they violated the copyright in years past. And when it was found out, they were held to a very high account. Copyright is a form of authority. It's a rule of law. Plagiarism is a lack of respect for that authority. It's refusing to be subject to it. Now, you never thought I would ever have to give a sermon on copyright, and I won't, so you're safe. You're safe in that respect. That itself is not my point. The concept of authority, though, is my point. Plagiarism is a refusal to accept the authority of the copyright. When you look up the word authority and you understand how it's defined, again, it surprised me a little bit. Authority, at least in my old dictionary, it's the right and the power to command, to enforce laws, to exact obedience, to determine, and to judge. That's what authority is. Now, that just seems a pretty far-reaching concept of authority, the right to authority and the power to authority. Now, if you just rule by power, I have an article I pulled off of, this is pulled off today, off of the website, one of the news sites that I go to, and the headline says, 220 billion pounds. It's in a British reference. 220 billion pounds stolen by Nigeria's rulers. Now, you'd think they'd throw some of that around when I was there, but, you know, it seems to have already disappeared. The scale of the task facing Tony Blair and his drive to help Africa was laid bare yesterday when it emerged that Nigeria's past rulers stole or misused 220 billion pounds. That is as much as all the Western aid given to Africa in almost four decades. So all of the aid of all the Western nations given to all of Africa for the last 40 years is about the same amount as what some of the past rulers of Nigeria stole or misappropriated just out of their own country. Now that's why Nigeria has the reputation it has in the world for corruption, because it's corruption that is beyond measure. Now, the current president actually has a commission to go out and investigate the past rulers, so it's not like it's referring to the present, but the president still has a bit of a way to go. The figures compiled by Nigeria's Anti-Corruption Commission provide dramatic evidence of the problems facing next month's summit of the G8 group of wealthy countries, which are under pressure to approve a program of debt relief for Africa. And some of the complaints are that if you give away the debt, if you forego the debt, it will simply be re-incurred because of the corruption and the mismanagement and the decisions that are there, that are being made. Gordon Brown, the chancellor, has spoken of a new Marshall Plan for Africa. You know what the Marshall Plan was? The Marshall Plan was to rebuild Europe after World War II. And the concept was, if you rebuild it, they will be prosperous and they will now be allies and our friends. Nigeria's rulers have already pocketed the equivalent of six Marshall Plans. We're talking about rebuilding Europe after World War II, and we're talking one country whose past rulers have pocketed six of those, six Marshall Plans. After that mass theft, two-thirds of the country's 130 million people, one in seven of the total African population live in abject poverty, a third is illiterate, 40% have no safe water supply. Mr. Obasanjo, the current president, will travel to the G8 summit to press the case for debt relief. Nigeria is Africa's biggest debtor. It also has the most minerals and the most oil of any nation in Africa in terms of the ability to have resource. Loans indebted at 20 billion pounds today because previous rulers not only looted the country, they didn't just take and use the money that was there, they borrowed against the future. So they not only looted the past, but they indebted the future to where it's almost hopeless to dig themselves out of the mess. Now that's authority by power. Where, though, does the right to authority? You see, the definition of authority was the right and the power to rule. So we know where the power to rule comes from. It comes by the fist, it comes by the gun, it comes by maybe by the ballot box, and then by corruption. But where does the right to rule, to exercise authority, come from? True authority comes from God, obviously. But on what basis? We know that God has the power. But on what basis does God have the right to rule? Now that sounds almost blasphemous to say that. On what basis does God have the right to rule? Not just the ability and the power to exercise himself. It's important to understand that because it is through that means that God grants authority to others. And we have the power, we have the right. Let's say, maybe stay on the side of the right. We have the right then to exercise authority as well. You know what the root word for authority is? Where the word authority comes from? It's real simple. You wouldn't think of it. It's like recreation and recreation are the same word. And to recreate or to recreate is related. It has a very similar background and purpose. It's to restore, to renew, to refresh. All right, so just think about the word authority. What word is right there in the middle of the word authority? It is the word author. And if you look up the word authority, and it'll trace you back through various European languages, and it'll take you back to Latin, and it will say the root word in the Latin is the word that means author. Authority comes from author. Author is an English word, but again, it's a translation of the Latin. Do you know what author means in Latin? It means creator. Authority comes by creation. If you make it, if you build it, if you create it, you invent it, if you write it, it is yours. It is supposed to be new and unique, and that's why plagiarism is such a crime in a civilized society, because it is theft. You have stolen something that someone else has created and has a right to the proceeds or the benefits of that original concept. And so plagiarism truly is a very high form of theft because it steals something that someone else has created. If you look up the word creator in the American Heritage Dictionary, the number two definition said the beginner, the originator, or the creator of everything. I mean, if you look up author, which means creator. But if you look up author, it means the beginner, the originator, or the creator. So when an author writes, he creates something new, he has ownership. If you take ownership strictly by force, that's stealing. But if you create something, then ownership is conferred with that. You now have the right to exercise the object indeed that you have created. This is important because it's where God bases his claim, not just where he has his power. And it is where the authority is transmitted to us in various ways as well. We need to understand and use authority well. It is an important concept in the Bible. Jeremiah 18 in verse number 1. The word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord saying, arise, go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause you to hear my words. I'm going to teach you something. I'm going to teach you the lesson of the potter. And I went down to the potter's house, and there he was, making something at the wheel. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hand of the potter. Have you ever run a potter's wheel and you're working with the clay and all of a sudden it doesn't take the shape you want and you smash it back down? Then you got to pop all the bubbles out of it and you cut it and smash it, cut it, smash it. And then you start all over again, raising up and making something maybe completely different. It says it was marred in the hand of the potter, so he made it again into another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to make. He can make whatever he wants. It's his clay. It's his decision. And when he gets done, it is his creation. Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter? Says the Lord. Look, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. And so God created us. And he built us into a nation, first Israel, now spiritual Israel is what we're part of. But he's building us into the temple. And so God says, look, I made you. I'm working with you. Individually, I'm caring for you. You're mine. I have the right, not just the power, I have the right to guide and direct you and to use you as I will. Romans 9 rephrases that concept, and it just says, does not the potter have power over the clay? Because he is the creator. He didn't steal it. He produced it. Now go to Exodus 20. I want to look. When God begins to lay his law out, he first lays out in Exodus 20, not why he has the power to give law, but why he has the right to give it. And so he begins to lay out his case as to where his authority is derived. I mean, nobody's going to question God's power, but God has the right. Exodus 20, verse number 1. God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. He says, I redeemed you, I saved you, I brought you out of slavery, and you have come now to me. You are mine. You were in bondage, and now you are free. That's a statement of God's authority, and it's the basis for all the commandments that follow. He is the potter working with the clay. Verse number 3. Again, notice how God restates his authority. And then he goes back to the very bottom basis of why that authority exists, at least in our own mind. Verse number 3, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any graven, any carved image, or any likeness of anything that's heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. He's saying, I have the ability to punish you, to bless you, and do not go against me. I want to bless you forever. Verse number 7. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Again, God says, I have authority. I will use it. And then it goes on down, though, to the basis of where that authority comes from, at least in our respect. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your manservant, nor your maidservant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For, because, this is now where God says, because I have a right to you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. And so he just says, I am the creator. I made the heavens and the earth. I declared the Sabbath day myself. Christ is the Lord of the Sabbath. We were created. The Sabbath was created for man. We were created for God. And so he says, I'm the one who made it. I have the right to give this to you in this way. Here is how my authority is exercised and where it comes from. Now we know the commandments are broken down into two parts. Matthew 22 describes those commandments, again, playing out in that way. Matthew 22 and verse number 34. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together. And one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him and saying, Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said, You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. Now he says, this is the first and great commandment. The great commandment is to love God. Which of the Ten Commandments are the great commandment? The first four. Okay, so there is a, when he refers to the first four commandments, God refers to the first one, and it represents all four. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. That is to say, you shall have no other gods before me. I come first. How do you think he refers to the second commandment? I've never quite processed it this way, but I began to study through authority and where the authority comes from and how God lays a basis. When he lays out the Ten Commandments, he says, I have authority, I will exercise it, but here's where it's coming from. I made you. And this is the basis. But then he says, verse 39, the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Where does it say in the last six commandments, you shall love your neighbor as yourself? Well, they do collectively. But again, collectively, the first four say love God. And God says the first commandment is the one that is the entry to that, the basis for that. Then the next six commandments are love man, love your neighbor as yourself. But what is the entry commandment that lays the basis for how we should love our neighbor, how we should love our fellow man? Well, it goes on. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Again, great commandments to love God based on the fact that God is the creator. That's what God presents as the reason that he gives in the most fundamental sense. The second commandment is to love man, love your neighbor as yourself. Again, I want to address the commandment that lies at the heart of that. It has to do with creation. It has to do with where does the authority come from and how is it therefore dispensed? And goes, where does it go forward from at that point? God made us to be like him in appearance and in our nature. Our nature goes beyond a physical creation. Our nature includes the spirit of man, which means we now have the ability to be called through the Holy Spirit. And our nature is including, ultimately in the church, the Spirit of God, which means we can actually have Christ in us. We can begin to think like God thinks. You know, again, I've mentioned this before, but it was like this week, partway through the week, I just went back to God and I says, God, just put your bars around me for a while. Protect me. You know, I can sit there and I can fight the battle. I can struggle with the battle. I can try to direct my thoughts, and the time comes every so often, I just have to say, God, just close your bars around me and let me have just some space. I just want to walk under your direct care for a while. And I've done this at various times, and you know what? It's an amazing thing. All of a sudden, it's just like everything clears away a little bit, and all of a sudden, life just is smoother. And I realize I go through a period of time where I'm just, you know, it's like footprints in the sand, except that's so trite because it's been said so much I rarely quote it. It's literally a point where God's carrying me, and I know it. I just know that I'm walking around, and life is smoother and easier, with a little less stress and trauma, a little less test. And I know it's a special protection, and I know it's temporary. Because God isn't going to carry me the whole way and do the whole job and do that all the time. I have to be strengthening myself. I have to be making choices. But there's times I just say, God, you know, give me some space, carry me for a while. And he does. He carries me right along. And so then a few days went through like that, and all of a sudden everything was just smooth. I thought, you know, that's nice. I really like and appreciate that. So God puts himself in us in various ways. But notice Genesis 1. If we go back to Genesis where the creation is referenced, in verse number 26, God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle and over the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. Man was given dominion. But the reference here is to the fish and the sea and the birds and the cattle and over the creeps. We're supposed to have dominion over the creeps. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. And God said he blessed them. God blessed them. And he said, be fruitful and multiply. Now this is personal. This is the family of God, ultimately. Be fruitful and multiply. Fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish and the birds and over everything that moves on the earth. So when he talks about building up the family, he says, be fruitful. This is a bounteous thing, and multiply. And then when he talks about the creation, he talks about dominion. You see, he doesn't say dominion in the context of the family the way he talks about it in the context of the animals. We will do with the animals generally as we please. I mean, there's always a disaster story in Reader's Digest. And they always say, you know, this has never happened before, but there will be another one we can write about next month. And it's always a bear somewhere eating somebody. So, I mean, our dominion is limited in some respects. But we have dominion over the creation. But it doesn't say that we have dominion over each other. Now, this comes up. It says, wives, submit unto your husbands. Okay, let's have a whole sermon on submission. Guys, yay, you know. Who says, wives, submit unto your husband? Does the husband say it? No. Can the husband say it? Not if you're smart. It doesn't work. God never told the husband to make his wife submit. He told the wife to submit. And so she does that for God, and hopefully out of love for her husband, or out of love for the children, the family, or the church or society. But the command is from God, it's not from the husband. Now, when you turn that around, husband, love your wives. Can the wife demand that her husband love her? That's the same argument. No. No. We were driving in today, and I had a letter in my hand. Well, Megan had it, and then Derek had it. It was floating around. It had to be dropped off. And I'm the only one driving the car, but I'm the only one who's not giving instructions. You know, Megan's telling me where to do it. Michelle's telling me. Derek's got the letter in front. Everybody's telling me what to do. So I went by the mailbox where Michelle said to drop the letter off. And I think Megan asked me, Dad, how come you didn't do that? I said, because your mother told me to go to that box. I'll go to the box I choose. I'll pick my own box. Everybody's telling me how to drive the car. Everybody's telling me where to turn. Everybody, where to drop off. I'm just telling you what reality is. If Alan comes back, when he gets back, he has to edit this out of the sermon, fine. He can sanitize the sermon, make it look really good. Wow, we've got a great minister. Nothing ever goes wrong, you know. Fine. But the reality is I want to choose my own box, thank you. So I'm just saying, the wife cannot demand the husband to love her. It doesn't work. If you do it, it's probably going to get worse. And if the husband demands the wife to submit, it will probably get worse. Now, I can say, oh, but we should be so Christian and so humble. Fine, we should be. And we should be able to sort out and remove that kind of stimulus and just make our decision based on what's right. But still, in the Bible, God never commanded the husband to tell the wife or the wife to tell the husband. We answer in that sense to God. So the dominion is exercised in a way that is productive to the relationship, or we put ourselves at risk. Subdue the fish. Subdue the birds. Bearing children in a family is an act of creation, right? Now, it's creation by God. God has to give life, but it's also an act of creation through the parents. Therefore, the parents become the potter with the clay. They have authority. They have right. Now, God's perfect, and so when he uses power, he uses it perfectly. But when we use power, when we use authority, we need to stop and exercise that maybe in a much more tender manner, because the tendency to use it by the power of our authority is so easily abused. So the authority given to the parents comes over the children because they are the creators. They have the responsibility by God to exercise rulership in that way. Deuteronomy 6, verse number 4. God, in different places in the Bible, in different ways, refers to the two great commandments. It's not just in Matthew, and it's not just in Exodus or Deuteronomy, 20 and 5, where the two commandments are. In different ways, God relates concepts that are parallel to those two points. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4 and 5. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Or the Lord our God, the Lord alone. The Lord is our God. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. Okay, would we not say that's the first commandment, the great commandment? Would we then possibly not expect that the second commandment in some relationship might then follow? I mean, when we're looking at this concept, well, just look for it as we go down through this. Verse 6. These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them in the doorposts of your house and your gates. Again, I asked, what is the fundamental base on which the second commandment has been built? I didn't actually go and say that, but I would assume, based on what I've laid out, that it at least is in your mind. If the great commandment is love the Lord your God with all your heart, and it says to teach your children diligently and talk to them, and when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, it has to do with indeed the relationship to our children that is the basis for the second commandment. For all of loving, first we have to love that which God gave us by authority, in order to extend it then out into society as a whole. So go back to Exodus 20, and verse number 12. Okay, here's the first commandment of the second set. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God has given you. The first commandment with promise, as it is said. Honor your father and mother is the base on which the second commandment is built. It is that foundation of the social structure. It is spoken of differently in Deuteronomy 6 because it says, teach your children. But the point is, love them in such a way, nurture them in such a way that they will be responsive to you. God commands the children to honor their father and mother. Now, we can teach them to honor us, but can we demand our children to honor us? We can only demand they obey us. How do you teach them? You teach them with nurture and with love and with care. You teach them by example. You teach them by building that relationship. Now, when a mother or a father or both breach the relationship, who is left to tell the child to still honor them in a responsible way? Only God. Ultimately, only God. I believe that that is indeed what God intended as a basis for loving our neighbor as ourself. Psalm 127 gives a reference to the responsibility that is passed on to us. Psalm 127, verse number 3. Behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. God is producing His family, but He's producing it through us. And He has the right to authority by creation, and He gives us the right to authority in our family structure by that same creation, by our own biology and by our own nurture and our family structure. Children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, so are the children of one's youth. Happy is the man who has his quiver full of them, that shall not be ashamed, but shall speak with their enemies in the gate. Arrows in the hand of a warrior. Is that just potential? Or is not the point made that when you shoot an arrow, you shoot it in a target? You're going somewhere. There's a point. It's not just deterrent. We've often said the family structure is at the very heart of a nation's. Obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. The first commandment of putting God first. That there's another first commandment. And that basically one is a commandment of loving God, and one is a commandment of loving your neighbor, loving each other, loving mankind. But then there's a qualifier here. It says, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath. So the children are being told by God to be honorable and to honor their parents. But then it says, fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. So the problem with authority is that it is abused sometimes, and it causes much damage and destruction in the process. We need to respect authority before we learn to exercise it. We all will exercise it. We do have our families, we have our jobs. In some cases, people work for us, in some cases, we work for others. But we must learn the lesson of authority well. Rex Sexton wrote a commentary on the website, United's website, on graduation addresses, on commencement addresses, recently. And I pulled it off because Cecil Moranville on the Elders Forum said, you know, you guys need to look what Rex wrote. Don't miss it. Because I don't go to our website and see everything that's on there. I get the notes that tell me what's new. My time is limited, and so I don't read most of it. So I went back and I looked it up. I want to read it to you today because he goes through and he shows the difference in what has happened in our social structure and where the focus is. Graduating time is here once again. Well, we just passed through that very recently. High schools and colleges are honoring students who have worked and studied to receive a diploma or degree. But what are the messages these graduates are hearing? What themes are drumming into their ears as they move on to the next cycle of life? Then he gives some examples. He says, look inside yourself for answers. Question authority. Seek your own values. Live life as you want to live it. The message largely has become, you must be personally fulfilled. What do you want out of life? You want to be happy? Well, you go get it. You want to be rich? You go get it. You want to have a big house and a nice car and a boat and whatever comes with it? Here's how you get it. Go for it. You're out of school. He says, I've been attending graduations for almost as long as I can remember, not only for my own three children who are now graduating from college, but as a pastor, I try to attend. I wasn't going to read this. It makes me look bad. I kept saying, well, I can't take it out. Well, I'll take it out. No, go ahead. Just suck it up, you know. But as a pastor, I try to attend the graduation ceremonies of youth in the congregations I serve. About 20 years ago, I began to notice a marked change in the messages given by graduation keynote speakers. Previous years, young graduates were almost always admonished to stand by the principles of honesty, integrity, selflessness, diligence, and service in the way they made their way into the world. Biblical principles were alluded to, and speakers often quoted with the great wisdom of the founders of the nation or its greatest leaders, such as Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington. I heard on the news, I think it was yesterday, I don't know if it was a city or it was a school district that was changing the name of the school from Jefferson, because Jefferson was no good because he owned slaves. And so they're naming the school Sequoia or something. Yeah, a tree. You know, Jefferson was kind of tainted. What can you say about a tree? You know? I thought, oh boy, not anymore. He says, if you attend a graduation at a school near you this year, it's likely you'll hear a message about how great the self is. Following the mantra of the times, you'll hear graduates bathed in flattery about the goodness of each one of us and how they must always trust their feelings and instincts. A line I hear regularly is, find your own values and live by them. Does that make sense? The graduate is told to set himself up as the ultimate authority, to choose and set his own guidelines for life. What if he's tempted to break these values? The answer is simple. If you're the lawgiver, if you create the law, you can change them. So if you make it yourself, you can change it. You can do what you want to. The message that this often repeated graduation theme sends is that everyone is his own ultimate authority. To understand where this message is taking us, just look at the current trends in Western society. Prisons are overflowing. 30% of all babies born in the United States are out of wedlock, across the board. Illegal drug use is an ever-growing social cancer. Do we have any meth around here? Anybody heard about that? I mean, unbelievable. You can't even hardly get the people to stop. And they'll go bust a lab or something, and there's kids in the house, and the walls are poisoned. You have to rip out the rock, the sheetrock and everything. I mean, you can't even hardly use the house. And there's kids walking around in there. Corruption at all levels of business and government is in the news as never before. Also, as a result of marriage and the traditional family being maligned and denigrated, millions of people are living sad and lonely lives. What messages should our young graduates hear as they begin life as responsible adults? Well, they should be reminded of how precious liberty is and how it's only kept through diligence. A few heart-stirring quotes from Nathan Hale, Thomas Paine, Ben Franklin, Abraham Lincoln, Theodore Roosevelt, Ronald Reagan, and other honored forefathers would do. Next, they would benefit from being reminded that there is a creator and a legitimate lawgiver who has the right to his authority. Not just the power, he has a right, because he gave the laws and he created all of us. The principle of Proverbs 3 and verse number 5 could be read. It advises, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not to your own understanding. Followed by verse 7, do not be wise in your own eyes. Perhaps some additional biblical principles could be thrown in, such as, your reward will be according to your works, and what a man sows, he shall also reap. Due to the political climate in Western society today, it's likely that few graduates this year will hear the kind of messages that they truly need for success in life. If you have graduates in your family, why not take the time to give them some valuable information for their future? Give each of them a Bible. Ask them to treasure it and read it regularly to become acquainted with the teachings of our Creator. He has given us laws to live by and principles to guide our lives. So I looked at that and I thought, you know, that's absolutely right on the money. That's where it stands today. We have our authority derived from creation. God, by creation, has the right to tell us indeed what life should be like and how we should live it. And the parents have the right, by the creation that God gave them of their children, to be able to instruct and to teach and to guide their children in that way. We become, you know, the potter with the clay. Now, the Apostle Paul's the one who gave all the instruction on marriage and most of that in the Bible. He never has any wife or family that we see. It's not exclusive to that. The Apostle Paul was a teacher of marriage and family relations, and he was single. But he applied all those things. The church is a family. It's a congregation. It's a body of believers that work together. Has anybody here ever had to stop and turn the other cheek toward anyone else in this congregation? Of course not. Aha. Right? Okay. But we're here. We're here happily, willingly. And so the fact is, that is something that we indeed know we need to strive to do. And the reason that we're able to assemble together in peace is not because life is always sweet, it's because we choose peace. We are peacemakers. Why? Because I told you to? No, because God told you to. Because your mate told you to? Because God told you to. And we answer ultimately to Him. I'm heading out first of the week for Challenger Camp. There he goes again, you know, off into the wild blue yonder. Hopefully we're going to leave on Monday. I'm not even going to assume it will be early on Monday, because I know better. And it may not be till Tuesday, because I'm just tired of being up all night trying to leave. So I decide I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. So at some point of the week, we're leaving. We're going to Challenger Camp. Megan's going with me. Michelle and Derek will stay behind. We have a new activity this year that we're setting up. Paul Lukey wants me to meet him there because we have to set up the activity. It's a problem-solving course. He wanted a team-building exercise that was specifically designed to work a group together as a team, where we set the leadership up and the exercises up where they need to accomplish something together. And they need to do it in a way that builds each other up. Chris Moen is actually going to run the activity, but Paul and I, again, are going there to set it up in advance. They're going to be doing some orienteering. We're going to give them a map. We're going to give them a topo map of part of the Tetons on the side of one of the slopes, and then we're going to give them a few compass heading and some distances, and they're going to have to find their way. We're going to give them ropes and an instructor from the rock climbing staff, and they're going to have places where they possibly either have to climb or rappel off the rocks to continue on the course along their way. And then we're going to give them a rope and a few knots, and we're going to tell them to make a bridge and cross the stream and don't get wet. And so Alan is gone, but Alan's been taking some safety courses, some whitewater rescue courses, and he's learning to do a Tyrolean traverse, which is a rope you run across and you secure it in a certain way, and then you go across with your hands and feet, and you can tie yourself to it as you go. But so we practiced on that a bit, and I bought the rope yesterday and some pulleys and to set it all up. But we're going to have them build a rope bridge where they all have to cross this stream and then do it up in the air and tie off to some trees or some stability on one end or the other. You know, I'm not trying to teach them to be a good rock climber ultimately, or a good rope bridge builder ultimately. I want to teach them to be good people, moral people. I want to put them in a position where there's a little bit of stress in a right and proper way, and I want to see them work it out. I want to see them choose a leader, and then I want to see the leader actually exercise authority in a way that builds the team and not destroys it. I want to give them a challenge in some way that they have to overcome, but they need to overcome it together, because everybody has to go from point to point. Everybody has to agree. We're going to set it up where everybody on the team has to agree before they can proceed. That this is the right compass heading, that we're in the right place on the map, that the topography on the map equals where we're standing, where the team has to be able to agree in order to proceed. And that's going to take some leadership. But it's authority that's exercised in different ways. We all have authority. We all have things that we're responsible for. Even being willing to submit is a form of proper authority. We have the financial committee meeting, and everybody doesn't just sit up and tell them, and I take out the agenda and I say, here's what we're doing, I want this, 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 and this, and everybody signs off and walk out the door. It never happens. We've had some discussions. We've gone through, and we've disagreed on some things. We've actually kind of split on a few things that I don't know about that. Somebody, I think that's pretty good. But it basically comes down to this: unless we can fundamentally agree, we don't do it. We just don't do it. So what does it take? It takes the ability for somebody to say, okay, maybe that's not my personal priority, but it's okay if there's enough of the others that really feel it's important. Or it means, if there's enough serious objection to what it is that we're considering, that maybe whoever wants it will just say, well, you know, really, if it's going to cause that much distress, then I think we should pass and just let it be. Because we have to do it as a team together. We just have to work together and we have to get along. That's important. Unity is too important to compromise. It comes at too high a price to simply let it go and deteriorate. So our families and our church and our congregation and the degree that we have participation in our community, those are team building exercises. And we exercise authority, and we need to know where the authority comes from, but we need to use it well. We need to respect authority, but we need to use it in a way that will cause others to respect it as well. We don't need to worry so much about what somebody thinks of us, whether we're getting our credit or our due, but we do need to be concerned that they think of us in such a way that they're willing to cooperate and participate, and if need be, submit themselves unto us in that way. We need to exercise authority in a way that causes unity and strength in the church. It is very, very important as a principle. God has the power, but he constantly explains to us that he has the right. I'm the potter. I made you. I'm the creator. When he gives his law, he says, I'm the creator. When he talks to the parents, he says, you are the creator. And when he talks to the children, he says, your parents made you. Now honor them and respect them and submit yourself unto them. But he talks to us personally. I'm so pleased with the growth and the development of the congregation over the years, with the relationships that are maintained. I hear all the agony, basically, maybe not all of it, but I hear a lot of it when there is agony, or when there is distress, or when there is friction. It comes back to me in one way or another, oftentimes in matters of maybe even personal or private counsel. And yet you can walk in this congregation on any given Sabbath, and when you walk in that door, there is joy. And I must say, that is a very, very important thing. I thank God that we are together and that he has given us opportunity to exercise authority in his name. And I ask that we be very careful with it and sensitive to it, that we lead in such a way that builds unity and strength, and that we simply, as a team building, the church is a team building exercise, that we continue on this course in our service to God so that we give glory to his name. We must use and serve with the authority that we have been given.